Well, brothers and sisters, I have only myself to thank for this predicament, so I can't complain, but I'm afraid I'm pure vitriol tonight after... I think after answering all the phone calls and so forth, I didn't think anybody would be here tonight. I asked all the questions that could be answered today on the phone, and there's still some people here. Well, here we go. Now, the last time, it's going to take a bit of doing here. Oh, could we have the... We're going to start right out with, we got into something. Turn it on, there we are. Yes, here's our familiar thing. The last time we got stuck on Jeb out here, and there's a great deal more to say about it, but this is the part that's preserved down to here, you see, well down to here, and then this is, they'd fill this in with hieratic. So I thought we might as well run through this part quickly because as we said before, the most important inscriptions usually are on the rim here. So we learn first of all, and we find it right out here, that the Jebat is part of a much larger complex. It's part of a great temple complex at Heliopolis, the oldest and the greatest in the world. It was usually thought to be that. So this, the Jebat, Jebabti, which is in, it's in another building, it is in the temple of the Benben. They've only written one Ben there, and that's a common thing, which in turn is in Heliopolis, which is most high and exalted, and then it says, it addresses, we'll see what the rest of this is presently. So it's in a place, you see. The Joseph Smith text reads, I am Jebabti in the house of the Benben in Heliopolis. So there are four stations. There's the Jebabti, there's the temple, there's the Benben in Heliopolis. It's a place where there are all sorts of monuments and so forth. And next he's identified both with the Ach and with the bull here. This, you see, this has been badly smeared here, but this is Ach. This is the Ach here, and this is the bull. Neket, the copulating bull, without equal, Nenseni, you see, who has no equal. He's not only a copulating bull, but he's a fighting bull. We find that out later. And so, we can't miss the whole cosmic significance here of the hypocephalus. Well, we don't. I'm going to skip some stuff here. What they had... all in common is a establishing contact and agreement between lower and higher beings, a place for such contact out of this world and so forth. Now, this Jebat here, it has at least 200 meanings, if you can imagine, perhaps the richest word in the language, and it could be all sorts of things here. And there's definitely a connection with the Hebrew Teba, which means an ark. You see, the Teba is the ark, Jebat is the Teba. And the meaning of the Hebrew word itself, the Teba, the ark, the debet, a boat, tebet, boat in Egyptian too, it branches out. The Teba is the ark of Noah, but it's also the ark of the covenant. The ark of Noah is described and depicted by the ancients as a box or chest. And the ark of the covenant was depicted as everything from a moderately sized chest to an enlarged rectangular shrine to accommodate it. And finally, the temple itself is called the Teba, which in fact expands to embrace the holy city and even the universe. What the hell took me there? Oh, God. Well, anyway. So, now, for example, the Egyptians gave the name Teba to Esna, to Dendera, to Edfu, to all sorts of temples, as well as some cities in which they were found. And I would add Thebes to the list. Teba is the... Nobody to this day has the vaguest idea where the name Thebes came from. Isn't it interesting? The oldest city in Greece, Thebes, is the same as what claimed to be the oldest city. Well, it's called the primal place of the first life and the necropolis of the first divinity was Thebes. Well, that the oldest Greek city should be called Thebes and the oldest Egyptian city called Thebes. What's going on here? How did it get to be called Thebes? Well, the Greek one is the original. It's first mentioned. The first mention we have is in the Iliad, in the fourth book of the Iliad. But the city itself was received that name. As I say, there are all sorts of guesses about it. I have some various things here. how it could be derived, but today they've practically given it up. Now, I think it's nearer to Thebes than anything else. Cheva probably means Thebes as far as that goes. We're just throwing that in, no extra charge here. I sense it was called that. Now, this claim is made for, now the Acropolis of Memphis near Saqqara is called Cheva. There's a chain of shrines running the length of the Nile, and they have a common base name, which is Uin. Yunu. Uin is a stone column, a standing column, you see. And we have, let's see some examples of them here. Here. Now, oh gosh, got to go back now. Reverse. I'm really flustered tonight. I'm in a terrible state. I have no business being here, actually. You've decided that already, I'm sure. Now, this you'll all recognize as Saqqara, the third dynasty built by the great Snefru. And here is called the oldest, well, pressing the wrong button again, the oldest, well, all right, let's have it. Hi-ho. Forward. No, I'm finding backward. You see, they all look alike. This is very interesting, you see. Study them very carefully. You can imagine what a show they're going to get in. Oh, I'm going to talk about something totally different. Well, now, wait a minute. This says reverse. I'm supposed to be reversing them here. All right. Why does it keep coming back? I don't want that. I don't want to go forward. I want to go backward. It won't go further backward than that. Well, now you've seen that one. Well, thank you. Now look at this. This is, I say it's the oldest stone building, and it's magnificent. An enormous lot of excavation. It's the greatest complex in the world. It's a mile around the darn thing, say, a mile and a half, something like that. And it's huge, and it's the great meeting place. And notice the familiar, this is the old step pyramid of Saqqara and so forth. They're rebuilding a lot of these things today, but the stonework is magnificent. Fluted columns, just like Doric columns and so forth. You wouldn't believe it was as old as it is. But now let's see, let us go forward. And, well, why did you change? Are you trying to do it there? No, he says he's not. Well, I want to go back here. I don't want to go. Am I going to leave here? Oh, I'm going backward. Would you go back about three? Then before this one. I'm trying to get before this one. Well, that's it. All right, now the next one. Are you with me? Good. Now you notice this one. This is the same thing from the air at the time they were excavating it. I'll get this right sometime. The same thing from the air at the time. You see, it's enormous, and the tombs are added, and the bins and the storage houses, the places for ordnance. Is this where they had the said festival and so forth? It was tremendous. It's the foundation of the universe and all that sort of thing. The great assembly place. But now look at this one. Now, why did you knock it out? Look, I had it. Where is this one? Notice this is in Chicane Valley, Peru. This is in Peru. Isn't this the same place? Notice the great assembly place in front of it, the altar in the front of it. That's the same thing that we have at Saqqara, and the step pyramid and all the rest. You say, what's going on here? Well, we move forward. See, every time I turn it on, it goes off again. There we are. This is another one. This is Nersira. This is a very important one. See the same layout. See the altar in front of it, and the great benstone there, and the assembly places, and the ceremonial way leading to it, and all the rites that take place. There's a ship because it's near the Nile, so, but also the great enclosure and the walls and the rest of it. Well, at least I'm not doing the focusing on it. Thou canst not say I did it. Never shake thy gory locks at me. Now let me see now. Forward. Now, where is this? Now, I spent 8 months quite near here. That's Silbury Hill in Wiltshire in England. It's the highest artificial mound in Europe, 150 feet high. It's a magnificent pyramid, and by it is the greatest of the stone circles, the one at Avebury. Larger and older than that at Stonehenge. It's fact, 2,000 years older than Stonehenge. It goes to 4,500 BC. These tremendous circles of stones, and I have flown over it dozens of times, low altitude, and could see the ceremonial ways going clear out of sight, marked by lines of stones along there, from all directions, centering on this place, 4,500 BC, in England, you see. And this is the pyramid, and near to it, I don't have the any other pictures but this, but it's so familiar. And where the road meets the great circle and comes in, there are great basins, which they call washing basins, and there are the mounds of the kings, their royal graves there. There's a string of graves along a high place, the graves of the kings. And there's the Kennet Alley that goes down to the Kennet River. There's not the Nile, you see, but there's a processional way, just like the ones in Egypt, that go right down to the river, lined with stones on both sides. So what's going on? These people are doing the same thing everywhere. The reason we mention it here is because this, the most important of these is Heliopolis, and Heliopolis is mentioned more times in the Joseph Smith one than any other. Here's another one, you see, going down the Red Pyramid. See how it goes down to the river here? And you follow the same pattern. Ah. Well, why did you turn it? I didn't touch this thing. I swear. This is the one at Deir al-Bahar, you see. They follow the same pattern well up from the river in this place, you see. But you get the idea. I'm going to press the button again. Hang on. Okay? This is a map. I'm not focusing. I do not command. There we are. That's beautiful. Well, thank you very much. And this just shows you the central location of it. There you find these megalithic centers by the hundreds in Western Europe. There are hundreds, over 1,500 of them have been located. They're all over. You get it in Palestine, too. This one is right down here at the base of the Nile, right here, you see, in Heliopolis. And it's equidistant. Here's the Minoan culture, which is related. And here is the Near East, Palestine, and so forth. Now let's have the next one, and this takes us down, of course, where it is in Egypt. There. What is going on here? Worked the last time. Now, there it is. See, there's Heliopolis right at the base of the Nile there. And this is the important... Notice how near Memphis is. It's just practically a walk there, and that's the oldest. That's where they're digging. The interesting thing is there are no ruins at Heliopolis. They're way back in the beginning. Marietta found a great circle with 365 stones, a significant number, but they used it all for ballast for the railroad they were building at that time. And Memphis is being excavated finally. It's a big job and a messy job because it's low down and damp. It's not high up like Saqqara over here. And notice, this is the line of pyramids. They're all along here, all these pyramids. And here's the one the BYU found right out there. Wait, there's a Dashur, yes. Due west of Dashur, out just right there, there is a pyramid of all things. No, it has to be at no least. Yes, you can see the Lake Maris and so forth. Well, that's an ancient map. So, do we have any more? So, what's going on here? The this same claim is made for all these other places, and they have the place of Iwin. I-W-N is, oh, the blackboard in here, that's all right. Iwin or On, the On of the Bible is Heliopolis, On, and it means a standing stone. And so this place is called Iwinu, which means standing stones in the plural. And Dendera, up the river here, is called Unit. And Esne is called Unti. And Ermint is called Iuni. So they all have that U. They all were places of standing stones. They were all megalithic centers. You get the idea from them. And if you read in the pyramid text where those are mentioned, what you do when you go there is to pesher, or to circumambulate. Beku or pesher, you circumambulate, you walk around them. The rituals have to do with that. Well, the pesher is the ritual running of the bounds by the king in England, his coronation. Not in England, well, they do that too, the running of the bounds in England. But in Britain, notice the same thing throughout the whole world, the ancient world. These are our people here. It makes you feel, used to give me goose flesh out there at Avebury, because my land, it was familiar, it was just like home. So, these were sunstones, and though they denote graves, the kings were also buried under them, They were also the means by which one below, the one below, Sokar Osiris, below, made union with the soul of Isis. Now I'm quoting Breasted here when he says, now these standing stones, when the sun struck them in the morning, that was when Re came down, and he came down to Osiris, the person who was buried under it, and when the light touched him, we've been talking about this all along, that then came the Jebedemji. The uniting of the two, and the work of the revelation of resurrection, and the universe started to turn again. It jump-started the universe again after things had nearly entirely stopped. So, the same association of burial and solar rites, as everyone knows, is characteristic of the megalithic establishment. At the head of the list is the great shrine, the Sun City Heliopolis. At the entrance of the Nile Valley from Asia and Europe alike, the rim of the Joseph Smith papyrus is unique. I think I have it next. Let's see now. Yes, because look here, it mentions this is Heliopolis here. See? Then you come around here, and this is Heliopolis here. And then you come around to the end, this is Heliopolis here. It's mentioned here, and it's mentioned in Heliopolis three times, probably four times. It's the only hypsephthah that mentions it much. This is a Heliopolitan document, in other words. This comes from, this is the cult of Heliopolis, and it's very important for other reason too. Joseph Papyrus, you won't find that on other hypsephthahs. Well, you say the repetition, could it be just filling in space? No, because you find the same repetition on the Leiden. When we showed you before, the great Leiden one shows the same repetition of Heliopolis, the figure on the rim, the one at the very top. The one at the top of the Joseph Smith one, one there, might as well be looking at it here. I'm going backwards here, and it's not reversing, it's going forwards. Ah, here it is. The Joseph Smith one here is, when you come to the top, that is a bend stone. That is you, and that's the sign of Hebetopolis too. On some of the hypocephalus, it's written that way. It's squat. It's not written this way, you see, but it's written that way, which is just as good. So it actually occurs there too. They all end up this way. You see, you begin in, he says, I am the great Jabab in Heliopolis, and you do the cycle, and you end up in Heliopolis. They all begin in Heliopolis, and they all, no matter where else they came from, they all end here. When you finish your cycle, when it's time to become resurrected, when it's time to continue the world and all that sort of thing, you make the full circle and end up at Heliopolis, the sun city, just as the sun itself does. And let's leave that on for a while, because now the Jebat takes us right to the shrine of the standing stone. Our guide to Heliopolis, chapter 162 of the Book of the Dead, we mentioned presently, informs us it's the high exalted Jebabti, which is the temple of the exalted Benben, and all the others it is repeated twice, the Benben stone, you see, Ben, the Ben, and we'll see what that means. Breasted recalls the time, he says, when the sun god, under his earliest name, Atum, sat upon the sacred Ben, the pyramidal symbol at Heliopolis. You've seen all those pyramidals, the great stone standing, take the form of pyramids in Egypt, at Heliopolis, and created the other gods. Since Yunu is dual, Yunu is dual, and Ben-Ben is also double, Ben-Ben, that's twice, if you notice, is duplicated. There were obviously two pillars, as everyone has noted, and Ezekiel says, the earliest manifestation of solar divinity, these two pillars. Were the Yunu and the Ben-Ben the same? Well, we're not dogmatic about that. Some think they were. Case says the Ben-Ben stone, at the primal place of origin of the earth, and the Yunu pillars were viewed as astral symbols. This is, they're stellar, you see, they're astronomical, which was, everybody writing, you know, about the great stone circles, Professor Tome and the books on that and so forth, always regard Stonehenge now as something of an observatory for observing the motions of the heavenly bodies. That was disputed for a long time, but some things we have to accept there. And we're quoting Case now, and the Yunu pillars were viewed as astral symbols which permitted free exchange of syncretism, allowing for every arcane interpretation. You can do everything you want with it when you get them together. He finds the original Ben-Ben to have been a stone fetish placed atop obelisks and pyramids at the high point where Atum Khepre, Adam, Khepre who becomes something else, first emerged from the primal waters. He posits that all obelisks and pyramids of Egypt were derived from the benstone of Heliopolis. That's the daddy of them all. The original form of Ray himself, which was perhaps a meteorite, well, it came from the sky. And we should allow every Egyptologist some license here. Henry Frankfurt considers the benstone a sexual or procreative symbol, as lots of people do. The term, you can be these things all at once, you see. The term House of the Benben, which appears twice in the Rim inscription of Joseph Smith, also denotes the place where the soul of Osiris dwelt. The name was applied to the city of Holy of Holies of the Temple of Atum at Amarna, used the very same name, the Benben, and the same place where the sun made its appearance, the name Ben, coming from the Weben, to shine, when you're, it's a burst of light. Weben means to burst out, to flood with light, to sun at dawn when it comes up, you see. The Hopis at the, on the second mesa, they stand, all the men and boys used to line up, they don't do it anymore, used to line up at dawn as the sun was rising, when the sun would pass through a niche on the horizon, they would all raise their hands to it every morning on the second mesa there, the south end, where above the cemetery where the coin rocks stand. It was the same sort of thing going on there. And even in this underworld aspect, the sun god at his lowest point is Sokar or Khonsu. At Karnak and Edfu, he conceals the secret image, his secret image in the Benben. Usually the king was buried under that, because that's where you make the contact. And originally the king was buried under it. And where was the house of the Benben? As soon as the Jebat is in the house of the Benben, our inscription immediately adds, the house of the Benben itself is in Heliopolis. The various steps here. The house, the Jebar, Jebabti, in the house of the Benben in Heliopolis. And that's most high and exalted. And then it came to the most noble, Sheptis. And Heliopolis, perhaps the most famous shrine in the ancient world. Most Egyptologists think it was the most ancient. Those shrines such as Abydos and Memphis and Hermopolis and Buto and Thebes, each one claims to be considered the first primordial place. It was the benstone that gave Heliopolis its priority, and others followed suit. Esnoid, Gebeline, Dendera, Edfu all display the same spear symbol as Heliopolis. That's the spear symbol, the spear of Horus at Heliopolis. See, there it is again. There, you see. Oh, there it is right there. And as Heliopolis. Karnak was consciously designated. Its name was the new Heliopolis of Upper Egypt. It sent out branches everywhere. The new Heliopolis of Upper Egypt. There was even a Heliopolis in Syria. We know this. We see all the elements coming together in an inscription, which Gardner has supplied. He says, O Ray, who was worshipped at Karnak, Karnak inscription, see, great of appearances in the house of the Benben, Heliopolitan, Lord and King of kings of all the gods, Falcon who dwells in the land of light. You see, you get the bird of light here, and you get the all the rest of it. The Benben, because we see the Benben is the Ben of Bird. We'll get that in a minute. Now, it goes on. Who hides his name from his children in his name of Ammon, thou art one who created all things. Now every one of those statements is found on a hypocephalus. This is the stock standard recitation for hypocephali, so there's definitely a connection here. All these main hypocephalus motives are brought together here in the Benben at Heliopolis. Gardner assures us that Seth's theory, we're quoting, that all the cardinal doctrines of Egyptian religion were evolved in Heliopolis cannot be refuted. That's where the whole thing comes from. So something's important here. And Blackman maintains that the basic Egyptian ritual throughout the land was the solar ritual of Heliopolis. And Barta has shown that it was the same at all times from beginning to end. Thus the temple of Ammon at Karnak, we're told, was an exact replica of the shrine of Heliopolis. And its high priest had the same awesome title of Ma'awer, greatest of seers in the temple. Ma'awer, greatest of seers in the temple. See, the king as priest of was an observer. See, it was an observatory. Heliopolis was an observatory at all times, of course. Anthus has written a great deal about that. As all these ancient megalithic centers were, because your stones were marking out positions of the sun, moon, stars on the horizon, times of rising, times of setting, and so forth. And he is called, the king is called in prehistoric times, the greatest of seers in the temple. The high priest of Heliopolis was also in pre-dynastic times, even Ptah of Memphis, was like a counterpart of Atum of Heliopolis, where the priesthood devised a theology to match that of Heliopolis. Heliopolis took the lead. Finally, the Book of the Dead, at least in its main parts, was born in Heliopolis, we're told. Well, it was the primal seat of kingship, and it's the king for whom the world of on Heliopolis assembled in order that he might be fashioned and act as king of eternity, as the enduring Horus of the everlasting. The high priest of Heliopolis in pre-dynastic times was, of course, the king of Heliopolis. We're quoting Blackman, Elwood Blackman there. For kingship and priesthood are not to be separated in high office. The king is a Heliopolitan, says a well-known pyramid text. His mother is a Heliopolitan. His father is a Heliopolitan. He himself is a Heliopolitan. He was born in Heliopolis as Ray. He appeared as the sun. The king appeared, was born in Heliopolis as Ray. At all times, Xanthus observed, the king of Egypt, in all his power, dependent on Heliopolis, where the tradition of kingship and the order of the world was settled in the beginning, the myth and cult of the sun god that goes back to the pre-existence, the council in heaven, this dramatization. This takes us back to the Shabako stone, way back. It was the great court of Heliopolis which alone could annually vindicate the king's right to rule as Horus against the counterclaim of Seth, because his rule was challenged. And the court of Heliopolis, the king has to clear his claim to authority every year, and he never cleared it. He has to come back the next year. It's always up for debate. In the temple archives of Heliopolis were kept genealogical records of the whole human race. The genealogy of the gods was kept there, and it remained the core of Egyptian mythology for 1,000 years, according to Memphis. The divine council, which figures so largely in Memphite theology, had to trace their genealogy back to the beginning of life on earth. And the sole right of deciding the legitimate claim to the throne, both of the king and Osiris. Now, I was going to draw, it's not an important thing, draw you this Ma'awer, the greatest of seers, the great seer or greatest of seers. He was the high priest of Heliopolis, and in the beginning he was the king. It's a reminder that the Heliopolitan doctrine was the cosmogenic astral creation story. They went back to creation, they rehearsed it and so forth. And one might well imagine Heliopolis itself as radiating sun following what Gertrude Tausing calls the emanation principle of Heliopolitan religion, like the temple, which is the center of our community. Everything is judged East Temple, West Temple, North Temple, South Temple. It was so. Everything with reference to Heliopolis, North and South. The nearer you were, the holier it was. Very strict. The emanation principle of Heliopolitan religion, the celestial center from which light streamed forth in endless abundance with all spirit and knowledge of higher spheres. The original transmitter would be the sunstone. What the hypocephali invoke, according to Spalaire's, now we're back to the hypocephalus itself, he says, is the most perfect form of cosmic energy representing later in the period of the sun of Edfu, which was the upper Egyptian Heliopolis, but incarnated in Adam of Heliopolis, even before the Old Kingdom. So the hypocephalus itself represents that cosmic energy incarnated in Adam of Heliopolis in prehistoric times. It all goes back to that, so it's older than you think. Though the incarnated god goes by different names at different shrines, all of them, Atum, Herkat, Kheper, are merely accidental forms of the ultimate source. The god which the hypocephalus has sketched on the same plan as the great sir, well, no, that's my shorthand reading. Could the hypocephalus be sketched out on the same general plan as the great stone circles or something like that? Well, there's a connection, certainly. The question is premature, but all discussion begins with premature questions, so we can begin with that, but I'm not going to. Now, the Bennu bird next, the Bennu, you see, the Ben-Ben is the bird, is the stone on which the Bennu bird sits. He's shown in doing that in some of the hypocephali. One cannot invoke the Ben stone without the awareness of the Ben-Ben, or the name of the Ben-Ben, without invoking the Bennu bird, recognizing that Bennu bird is also the phoenix, Boinesi, the phoenix, its name. That bird of light, which is not to be divorced from the Aku. We've seen Aku all along here. The dead becomes an Aku, the king becomes an Aku, the bird of light is an Aku and so forth, what the Germans call the Verklärter, an enlightened spirit, one who is saved. He's the Aku bird. He figures conspicuously on the rim of some hypocephali, even as the Benben does in the Joseph Smith exemplar. It's been customary to derive the name of the phoenix from the Egyptian Binu, pronounced Boina, according to Case, which is the same as Ben or Benben, the ultimate source being traced to Weben, which is the bursting forth of light, to shine, Weben, let your countenance shine, and so forth. As is well known, the phoenix has lent itself to a wealth of legend and speculation, but on some things all are agreed. One is that it was a bird of light, whether as the European phoenix, the legendary father of Europa, the patron god of Sidon, representing the blood-red morning sun, or the Egyptian phoenix whose name is related to the benstone on, mostly with reduplicated form of Benben, we're quoting somebody, symbolizing the sun god and represented by the bird Ardere Purpurea. Of course, you think of some things as the Zhaptitsa, the Central Asiatic firebird. You all know the Rimsky-Korsakov firebird. Or others, if you want it, what would another be? Beside the Zhaptitsa, I'll think of one in a second. The other undisputed quality of the phoenix is its periodic death and rebirth in a strictly astronomical cycle. That's why phoenix gets its name. It's not going to rise from the ashes now. It'll have to rise from the water, according to the latest news report. The place is flooded with rain. The rites of the phoenix, the Bennu bird, celebrate the great Sothic cycle as well as the solar year. From an inscription, we learn that the phoenix cycle not only was 500 years, but also 450, 1,000, 7,000, and the Sothic cycle of 1461 years, we won't go into that now, of 300 days, or 1460 years of 354 and a quarter days. The lifespan of 12 phoenixes represents the length of the age of the world itself. The best known phoenix, so I see the phoenix is the great timer. There's a stone standing, and of course it's the shadow that you use to time. You can tell by the shadow when the solstice comes and so forth, what time it is of day or night, or what time it is of year, using that. The best known phoenix story is the account of how the bird returns to Heliopolis from Arabia at the end of every 500 years to sacrifice itself on the ash, on a nest on top of the benstone here. It sacrifices itself and then arises reborn from the ashes. Now this story has variations, but all show the phoenix to be the same Bennu bird and the symbol of eternity and resurrection. As such, the Christian fathers make most of it. The Epistle to the Romans of Clement I, the earliest of the church fathers after the New Testament itself, Clement I, he uses the device of the phoenix to convince the doubting Christians that the resurrection is real. So if that isn't so, what about the phoenix? The phoenix resurrects itself, so he uses that as an argument. And that's picked up by the first and best probably of the Latin fathers, like Tanzis, who writes the story of the phoenix, who was picked up and written in a great English poem called the Song of the Phoenix, the Poem of the Phoenix, the Anglo-Saxon song, which was written by no less a person than King Alfred. So you see how these things are heralded and handed all over the place, you mix them with your genealogy. Yeah, King Alfred wrote the Song of the Phoenix. Van den Broek finds the phoenix motif in Orphic and Pythagorean and Homeric lore, in the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Mysteries of the Ancient, the Firebirds, or the other bird, I didn't think it was the Garuda bird of India. It's all the same bird. Particularly relevant to our hypocephalus is Weidmann's conclusion that the Bennu signifies time as an eternal round, which repeats itself eternally and unceasingly, with emphasis on that instant at which the old and new day come together at sunrise. Of course, the new year the same way. This moment is accordingly that which the Book of the Dead designates as the unification of all that exists. That's a quotation. Notice there's your Deva Jemdi, the unification of everything. And every one of these symbols stands for this, and it was all organized together in a great cult, a great night. And I've written a lot of articles, not a lot, but quite a few, on this particular subject. I shouldn't have got sidetracked on it. But it's relevant here, without a doubt. This moment is according to that, well, we said that. A recent book on obelisks suggests a plausible background for the megalithics. You notice where these things still stand in Europe, and you will find a hawk sitting on top of most of them, because that's the best vantage point to look for prey. Here it's the top of a telephone pole, a telegraph pole, or a fence pole. In northeastern France, in Brittany, they sit on the top of menhirs. There's one which was 65 feet high, which you could see miles out at sea, and it's observed as a hawk sitting on top, and you could see why. You see. So the idea that the hawk is that horse, the hawk on top of the Ben stone, is he the Ben bird? Of course, he's interchangeable with all sorts of things. Well, now we see the spear of Horus here. We just should mention that. Incidentally, I say this is just thrown in extra. It really doesn't belong to the story. But yet it does, you see. We're all in this thing together. You can go down and visit the Hopis and go through this whole routine through the year. It's a shame to destroy it now systematically the way we're doing because they have mineral rights that we're anxious to get hold of. Don't get me preaching on that subject. On our hypocephalus, the name of On, or Unu, is written by two stones with a tall spear conspicuously protruding between them. This is the spear of Horus and is related to the harpoon attached to the floating skins of the Jebat, the harpoon of Horus of Edpu, according to the Verta book. It tells us that in the great dictionary. It's the same thing that's attached to the harpoon that's attached to the Jebat. So this thing here, this is a harpoon which was attached to this floating goatskins, a goatskin raft with floater to hold it up. See, when you went to hunt hypocephali. So these things belong together. It denotes a harpoon in this because it was a sacred harpoon. You see many, many pictures with Horus holding the harpoon up to harpoon Seth, who takes the form of a great serpent or hippopotamus. And the king would ritually hunt the hippopotamus at a particular time. Or he could be the great serpent. So, the word Jebar, among its many names, denotes a spear or harpoon. It's the spear of Horus of Heliopolis, with which he overcame the serpent who took the rule. When he took the rule, Raymond suggests that it represents the magical power which was created by the earth god at the beginning of the world. The initiated Heliopolis would be required to recite, I know the great spear, how the great spear of Heliopolis came to be, how the great Baldwin, the great old man, the great prince, they call him that, the ancient of days, came to be the great seer of Heliopolis. It represents the element of combat in the rites and the victory of light over darkness, the equivalent of the cherubim and the flaming sword. Where did it belong? Do I have something here? Yes. We'll get there in a moment. But should I might mention in passing here that the writing of the Ma, it's just the word, the phonetic word Ma, which is a plow. But inside, it's always written, the great seer's name is always written by a peculiar hieroglyph that's not found anywhere else, by two stones side by side. And this is called, this makes him the great seer. Of course, immediately we think of seer stones when you think of that. Could it become Urim and Thummim? Could it be the field lens and ocular lens of a telescope? I have a theory, another one which I'm going to throw in for no extra charge here. So what about it? We call them Urim and Thummim. What does Urim mean? It means lights, gathering of light. What does Tumim mean? It means perfection, definition, and so forth. Well, what does the field lens of a telescope do? It gathers as much light as possible. Make it as big as, that's the whole idea, gather as much light. And what do you do when you send it down to the eyepiece? You refine it, define it, you magnify it like a microscope. You look at it exactly. And of course, perfection, tamim, perfection. So you have the light gathering the perfection, represented it in Heliopolis at the great observatory there not by two eyes or two, you'd expect it to be something else, but no, two round stones side by side. A very interesting thing. Just a coincidence, I suppose. And now we come to the bull here. Well, play safe, I always say. Now we come to the bull here, the bull, Nekhat, the bull, the great, whom there is Nen, Nensen, and to whom there is no equal. And we got to get him in here, too. Everyone, of course, is impressed by the strength and fertility of the bull. Gee, I can't remember. The story of the contending Horus and Set in the letter is sent unto Neith the Mighty, the god's mother, in the name of the master of the universe, the bull that dwelleth in Heliopolis. Why is he represented by a bull? The bull of Heliopolis is very famous. The bull of Heliopolis is the equivalent of Lord. When the word is used there, it's the equivalent of Lord. And there's a close report between the pillar of On and the pillars of heaven there. The next page, I noticed a passage I had from the Nevis. From the pyramid text says, at his coronation, the king is Nevis, the sun, and the wedged eye, all at once, the whole thing around the sun. That's not it. Oh, here it is. in the pyramid text. It designates the great benstone itself. The determinative can be for the benstone. Instead of writing benstone, you write either a bird or a bull's head, a bird sitting on the stone, or a bull's head. And in that context, it is named the copulating bull of On, which is exactly what it's called here. See, the copulating bull of On, who is represented by the colon, which stands for him. And that's it, you see, there's the bull, and there's the copulation, and there's Heliopolis. So this is the bull we have here. And nothing is more obvious than the bull's display of strength as a fighter, which appears in prehistoric times in the Narmer palette, the oldest monument we have of Egyptian writing. Oops, got the wrong one here. Let's see if we got that now. Oh, there's the spear, incidentally. There is the spear of Horus right there, see, in the Book of the Dead. He's standing before it, the one that you have to worship. There it is, and you notice it's on the top of the stone. Ah, that's better, yes. Oops. Well, you get the general idea. It was a spear. He's holding one, too. Let's see what we have now. Oh, here's the one I was talking to now. Nope. Ah, here we are. See, this is the oldest document, written document we have in Egypt. Of course, the famous Stone of Narmer is supposed to be the first pharaoh and so forth. We won't go into that. But down here, is, he's teaching me a lesson, I know that. Here is the great fighting bull, and he's breaking down a wall and treading on the pharaoh's enemies here. And this is the great bull of Heliopolis, way back there. Is that Heliopolis? Of course, this comes from up the river. Now, the king. Now, in the Narmer palette, he's represented as the victorious. Hail to thee! Now we have another pyramid text. Hail to thee, Horus, mighty king, bull, subduer of bulls. He fights it. If he's a victorious bull, that means he must have had a fight. You see, if he was without equal, that means he must be the one who excelled. He's the champion. And of course, bullfighting has been flourished around the Mediterranean since time immemorial. In the Joseph Smith Hypocephalus, he's called the mighty bull without equal, the champion. Okay. And hail to thee, Horus, mighty bull, subduer of bulls, he called. As the victor, he also would be the deliverer. O mighty king, who hast expelled the darkness from me, thou likeness of Horakhti, chief of the imperishable stars. We are told further, the earliest stories of the constellations in the Near East have to do with the conflict between the bull and the lion, belong to a purely astral sphere, though it becomes a sport in many nations, having bulls fight lions. As you know, the Taurus and Leo are two of the constellations of the zodiac, and in the turn with the procession of the equinoxes, they have their turn. We are told further that the earliest stories of constellation have to do with that conflict. Along with its prowess as a fighter, he is the symbol of virility. There's lots of things on virility here. The three symbols of virility are the bull, the Nile, the sun, and the king. Indeed, our Hypocephalus, the bull is called procreator and fighter without equal. Kai nekhet uti senek. The final stage of the progress of Pharaoh Eunice in the rites of the pyramid show him as a victorious bull, the survival of the contest. Naturally, to be productive, the bull must have a mate, and of course, the cow. We've been looking at that all along in the Joseph Smith. The central is the cow there, the one upside down. And she's very important. Schott points out that the king at his coronation is not only bull, but Hathor the cow as well. He is both, Siegfried Schott. Book on that, that the king is both the bull and the cow and the secret Horus, and he's the phoenix and he's the Horus all at once. See, it's not impossible to do these things. Let me see what the next one will be. Oh well, there's the cow. You see, as far as that goes, he is the one that figures so conspicuously here. While the bull can turn up in context where it merely serves as a convenient reference for divinity, what we have here on the rim is the great Heliopolitan complex where the Mnevis bull is at home in the temple, consecrated to Atum while the shrine of Re was for the Bennu. At his coronation, the king was the Mnevis, the bull, the sun and the Wedjat Eye, all at once, the whole thing centered in the sun cult. And I said, well, we skip this. It was at Heliopolis that the cow and the bull, like the sun above the earth and below, give the idea of perpetual succession, which guarantees that birth follows death, continuing creation. Of course, and that we saw that on your hypocephalus. Remember, the cow is in the center, and she, the one at the top, and then the bottom. And so, for Heliopolis as the primal place, I've got to skip now, the birthplace, the throne place, was also the place of divinity, of the victor over vindication, where the rule of righteousness was established. As the two columns flanking the spear, the Jews, according to Kornfeld, were quite aware that the two famous pillars, Boaz and Joachim, that stood at the entrance of Solomon's temple, strength and righteousness, stood at the entrance of the temple there, belonged to the solar cult of Heliopolis. The Jews got them from Heliopolis. And this is an interesting thing here, that's in 2 Chronicles. The prominence of Heliopolis in the tradition of Israel leads us straight to the patriarchs. Heliopolis and Jerusalem are the two poles of patriarchal activity. The very early tradition has it that at Heliopolis that Abraham taught astronomy to the Egyptians, that science having first been given to the world by Enoch. Then we're told from the earliest times it was the rendezvous of scholars from all over the world. It was supposed to have been a strictly scientific study of the heavens by the Egyptians that cured Abraham of the astral fatalism of ancient religions. He turned from astrology to astronomy because of them. We've seen that Abraham's great-grandson, Joseph, married the daughter of the high priest of Heliopolis, who is our ancestor. She's the mother of Ephraim, of all things. And if you come from Ephraim, his mother was Asenath, and she was the daughter of the high priest of Heliopolis. That puts us right in the picture, you know. And Josephus recalls how the impure one of Avaris, that's a local pharaoh, incidentally, appointed Moses to lead the Jews when he, too, was a priest at Heliopolis. In 150 BC, refugees from Jerusalem under the leadership of Onias got permission from the elders at Jerusalem and the Pharaoh, even as the Jews of Elephantine did 400 years earlier, to build a temple of their own at Heliopolis, following exactly the proportions of the temple of Solomon. So they built a replica of Solomon's temple, the Jews did it, at Heliopolis. And Solomon, he married the daughter of Sheshonk, the founder of the 22nd dynasty, who in around 930, after Solomon died, sacked Jerusalem and took the vessels of the temple to Heliopolis. And the temple, the ordinances and the vessels have ended up in Heliopolis. And that was, some authors think it was the main purpose of Sheshonk, who's mentioned in the Bible, Shishak, in capturing the table to get the authority of Heliopolis. And the plunder of the temple at least improved his finances greatly. Well, and it's hard to believe that the opening lines of, we're quoting Jacquier now, it's hard to believe that the Elohist author of Genesis was not drawing from Hermopolitan sources, Hermopolis being the twin city of Heliopolis. And so it goes. Well, Jerome reports that the priests of Heliopolis spent all their time in the temple contemplating the natural causes of things, the motions of the stars, while observing the strictest rules of upright living. And finally, the tradition comes down into Christianity. The famous Strasburger Bestiary begins with a vivid scene of Abraham sacrificing Isaac, and then the scene is the phoenix sacrificing himself at Heliopolis. As a parallel to the sacrifice of Isaac by Abraham, we have the sacrifice at Heliopolis. So the ties are very close, so forth, and now we get to our talk. This we put in because I didn't want to pass this by as long as we were on it, that part of the rim. Now, it's time to begin. The of some 98 copies of the Hypocephala, which I've got now, we'll have to give Brother Jim Harris and others, besides Brother Harris, credit for collecting these diligently, riding around and moving around, traveling and so forth, to collect as many examples as they could. I got just from texts, just from books and periodicals. I never made much trouble about it. I got enough for a good sample. I thought I got about 50 of them. And then since then, of course, they've been added to. So I have about 98 of these. And an interesting thing happens here. There, 50 of them are illegible. That is, you can't read them, they're smeared up, or they have no writing on them. But 48 of them have inscriptions that can be read, and they split exactly in the middle. 24 of them contain the prayer, "O come to my rescue and rescue me, turn thy face toward me and rescue me," and the other is the answer to the prayer, "I am Jebabti, come down," or "I am an Ahu. See, I'm the Ahu, or the Ahu, who has come down to rescue you. So 24 of the prayers in the collection I have, they're equally divided between the prayers and the answer to the prayers. The lively use of the first, second, and third persons in the supplication and reply conveys a sense of dialogue here, an interchange that suggests a dramatic situation, and this is fully borne out in this document here, which is, ever since Champollion, right since the beginning, this was recognized, this is chapter 162 of the Book of the Dead, as the handbook and user's guide for the hypocephalus, how to make one and what it's supposed to do. So this is the one thing we want. But it's very significant that this chapter isn't found in our editions of the Book of the Dead. Very few of them. Fortunately, Alan, H. Allen has supplied us with the with the Milbank, with the photographs of the Milbank, and also of the Rainhauser, yes. Those two, what was his name? Anyway, it's the Milbank. And but they don't have them. The first, the big edition we saw by Naville, where they had all of them, he left it out on purpose. And the latest and completest translation by far is that of Horner, and he's left it out too, and they both give the same explanation. Two things. It is much too late to be alone in this particular setting, and it's alien. It's full of foreign words that aren't Egyptian at all, and Alan says they're Hebrew words. So there's something wrong here. So they don't include it. And what's even more alarming is that though all scholars recognize this document as the one and only explanation of the hypocephali, out of the 13 columns of Lepsius' text, only three are recognized by anyone as having any relationship to the hypocephalus. All the rest are, as Horak declared, not relative to the hypocephalus at all. They only recognize, here out of your 13 columns here, we have, yes, we've got them here. They're numbered, see, down here. Where's the button here? Yes. That's 13 columns. But all this they leave out, just this. This tells you how to make it and what to do with it. And they say, this has nothing to do with that. Well, this is the whole story. This is everything we've been talking about over here. Nobody pays any attention to it at all. So we'll read it and see what it says here. I think if we could, don't have time, I shall read it from here. I think the best thing to do is to go down here, because you'll recognize everything we do along here. Let's begin at the top here. And it begins here. This is a recitation for causing there to be a... Ah, I must catch you up here. I said it's too late. But is it too late? Let us go one ahead now. This, you see, this is the Berlin Papyrus, 3031. That's its number. And there it is, 3030. Oh, it's backwards in here. But that doesn't make any difference. See, the nice thing about Egyptian, read it from either direction just as well. No, that's true. That's true. You can go either direction. Makes no difference. And, but this is backwards here, but that doesn't make any difference. Well, but the point is here that this is from the 21st dynasty, from around 1085 to 950, 1,000 years older. They say this is too late, this other one is too late, but this is word for word, the same thing, round to here. This is the same thing, almost word for word. The differences are significant, but they're very few. But this is the same thing, and it's 1,000 years earlier. So don't say this is too late, and don't say it's alien either, just because it has a lot of words that sound Hebrew in it. So should we start reading this one or that one? Well, reading it backwards is not going to help. Well, this says, right at the beginning, we come to one important distinction here. It says a spell, we say a spell, recitation, a spell for causing, for ha, for throwing down, for causing to, or deep, to cause to thrown down or be thrown down, participle with the ending left out, it's a form, we don't go into that now, the abyss, a flame, see what that is, under the head of, and there's the Ahu bird, you see, well, this is hieratic, see, those pictures aren't any good, if it's pictures you're interested in, forget this, under the head, see, that's under the head of the Ahu bird, and then his name, the Osiris so-and-so, and gives his name, but the word we want attention here is shot here. Well, now let's go back to the other one, which is much more legible. Ah, here we are. So, this says, this is a spell for causing to come into existence, to hepper, to be there, to be a flame, a besh, under the head of the Ahu. There's the glorified one. See, there's the... That's the same as that's the conventional drawing of the phoenix. There, the phoenix bird, the Ahu bird, and they're the noble Ahu bird. But you notice, the older texts, say roughly 1,000 years older than this one, doesn't say to cause it to be there, but to cast it down, to throw it down. And this is what happens, it's the beam of light that comes down, it's the coming down of the light that's the important thing. And in the later periods, it's all just Kepper. But some of the oldest ones would say to send down, Hab, or to cause it, Ha, to cause it to come down, how to come down, or to cast it down. So this idea of the light coming from a distance and being projected down here. Well, I'm going to follow my translation already. We won't go that because we haven't got time. We have to move along here, I'll say. So it goes this way. Reads as follows, a recitation for causing it to come down. Well, a flame, again, a flame. This is the flame, you see, right here, there's, you see the flame, but it's called a besh. But what does besh mean? It means a fire, a spark, heat. Alan calls it heat. Budge calls it warmth. The Verta book, the great book, calls a besh, it says a flame, a fire, but especially a projection of fire, a casting forth of flow. That's what it is. That's what we have in the hypocephalus, remember? It keeps a bond with a star in heaven and keeps your head warm on earth. It keeps you in touch with the Ba, with your own, with your spirit up above. It preserves the body against the time when the spirit can return to it. So you have to keep that spark in the head so it will not die completely. Keep it warm. And that's the idea, is the idea of connection. And so when the Rutherford says that Bess means a projection of fire, an emanation, a bursting forth, that's Webben again, a bringing forth. Ba is anything contained under pressure, says the Verta book. Therefore, the verb bes is to initiate. The noun signifies what is secret, and besa, it means the mysteries. The word for bes is the word for mysteries. Bes is initiation too. And we think of the epopsia of the Eleusinian mysteries of the Greeks. So this is plainly a special kind of warmth or spark. And then we go on beneath the head of the Ahu. And that's the Ach again, the glorified being. And so recite the words as follows, you see, speak the words. Again, hail to thee, mighty lion. We start out here, hail to thee, mighty lion. Now we have a great deal to say about the lion when you deal with the hypocephalus. It's not just the colorless par. It's something that he plays a very important role here. The mighty lion is met with frequently in the hypocephalus text. He is always... See, here he is. There is the lion. Pehati, that's the rear end of lion, which is a regular symbol for might and strength, you see. And who wears the most, the high exalted plume. See, there's the two feathers. The lion wears the feathers too, but he's wearing them too. Everybody's wearing them. And Ray wears them. They're the sign of Ray. But he wears the two. So he is high, ka. He's holding his hands up. That's the symbol of high. See this sort of picture, right? Ka is high, and the feathers are actually pictured there, and the lion is there. But why mighty lion? Well, in particular, he's the guardian of the crown, the hypocephalus itself. Here's some passages here. The person in the coffin text, the person supine on the couch in the lion couch scene. The lion does not seize thee. Another verse says, Acher, the two-headed lion, seizes thee, Horus. The lion always guards the entrance to highly secret places of extremely limited access. The lion is Acher, is the double-headed lion in both. He guards the gates both coming and going. I have some pictures of him here. I think we're about ready to get to them. Well, then we can return to this later, I suppose. Let's go on here. Yes, here you got some see all these double lions you have here? He's passed, and at the top, only in hypocephali, at the top of the hypocephala, it's, well, of course, in the Anipapyrus too, you have it. It means one is called yesterday and the other is called tomorrow. See, one looks back at time, one looks forward. It's the passing, this is the moment between them. This is the instant when yesterday turns into tomorrow. When now, when the past instantly becomes the future. And you have it here, see? There is the sun on the horizon representing the passing of another day. This represents the passing of the time. The people are here in the spirit is resting before the spirit is to be united with the body. It rests here with a pleasant time. He's playing a game of senate, having a nice time with his wife. That means the Ba is being kept in reserve. See, there is the flame being kept alive, and he is praying and asked to pass on. When he passes on, you notice, then he is resurrected. This is a mound covered with flowers on some of them, like the Antipapyrus, is beautifully drawn, and he's holding both hands high over his head with life signs, honest signs, in both hands, and he is coming up and he's emerging triumphantly from the tomb, see, which is being watched over by Anubis here, by the faithful dog, and the two ladies are praying to him. Now, that's an important thing. I don't want to get sidetracked on everything here, but this is important too. And then he gets through, he's passed by, he is resurrected now, but he is shown very vividly on some of the finer papyri, breaking through the earth. This is a mound of earth with grass and flowers on it, and he's breaking out, he's achieved the resurrection. Here's before it, you see, he is in a booth, pleasantly in a booth, in a sa, they use the same words as the sa, sukkah, same word the Hebrews use for booth. He's playing with his wife, waiting in a spiritual state, but then when he passes this, then he is resurrected. The two ladies there, we said, to officiate as his birth, but more than that, they always signify that his death was a sacrificial death. That's very important, because they went around and gathered his members and put them together for resurrection. Well, here it is again, you see, he's doing the same sort of thing exactly. This is, and you see, obviously, this is a stock theme. Here are the two lions, and here are the two lions, they're representing the same thing. Now, let's see, here. Here it is, a colored one. You see, here is the ram emerging. Notice the ram is the old man, reaches the feebleness, a state of feebleness. This is a ram, this is a ram, and he's going to emerge now. And he's, that's your pen, and this god, but here is the lion. See, here's the double lion, but he's in between them. And remember, that ram, it's always the ram that represents the instant of transition. And here he is, the ram who was rising to the other one, Netzarpen, this ram, I guess there's walking legs. No, it's Dua, Nebdua, Lord of the Underworld, Lord of the Dot, that's what it is. The ram is Lord of the Dot, of course. Netzarpen, this god of Lord of the Duat here, and who is the Ba. It's the spirit, and he's going to be, and you notice the snake that guards him, because in tombs you're always going to dig or anything else, you're going to run into these snakes. But here again is the double cow, is the double lion, to the past and the future, you see. Parrot, see, this says going forth. And here's your ma'a, see, here's your, oh, this is ma'u, this is plural, you see, which is plural, well, that's the word for, one word for lion anyway. But there's your, with the two stones, I don't know how the third stone, that's the only one I've ever seen, with three stones in it, but don't start asking questions about that. Here's this Jimmy Dewitt, who is within the dot and so forth. Well, all these things I never thought I would talk about tonight, but I think they're relative just the same. Now, the salt papyrus, a very great, very old, very important ritual, says, I am the lion who became the ape. Remember the ape, the two apes that worship the central figure in our hypocephalus, who became the ape. The Ancient of Days, the one at the top, who is the old man. You find that on all of them. He's mentioned a number of times on some of the rims. The Ancient of Days, who hid himself in the flame without suffering harm. He's surrounded by flame. This certainly suggests something. These elements are conspicuously joined in this odd combination. The sun god is held as a predator, a bird, a lion, the bull in his city, the lion before his people, lashing his tail, sending forth his voice. The mysterious lion, now we come to this, because this is what it's going to tell us about the lion here. Thou art, yes, equipped with the flail. Go back to our mighty lion, it says in particular. Well, and we're looking at it, I guess I better return to it then. And this one, this is the easiest one to read, so I'll use it. The lion is the common form of Ray. It's one of the common forms. Remember, Ray has between 74 and 76 common forms, and he can take any other form he wants, but the lion is one of the commonest, you can see why. Their names are now pronounced alike, Rao Rao. The double plumes are worn by figure two in all the hypocephali, representing the sun god at his greatest height. He says equipped with the flail here. And there you see, it draws a picture of the Nehaha, the flail, the fly flat. That gives him authority and so forth, equipped with the flail. And the also, as you know, the king always bore one of those. Thou art Lord of procreation, bursting forth in light, shining abroad, down here, bursting forth in light, shining abroad here. And then it says here, Nemjeru Webneh. There is no limit to thy shinings forth. That's a spatial limit, that's a road there, you see. Thy shining forth through the webbing, as we would say, filling the immensity of space. Because gerund used in this sense with the road marker means space, and nenger, there is no limit to the space which your light fills. So we'd say filling the immensity of space. It refers to the coming forth of light, light giver. And then, thou art the master of forms, of countless appearances, as the sun is. Or say, the litany of the sun gives 74 to 76 forms of appearance. And these selbstverwirklichungen, the self-realizations, the forms that the sun can take, begin, we're going to quote Bhatti because it's so interesting, sun god, begin in the underworld with the mummy who sleeps in the secret place. In the underworld, he is ram-headed and always, and he wears the solar disc on his head, the solar crown as the hypocephalon. That was what we saw, that ram there had a solar crown on his head. Concealing himself from his children. Notice he has countless forms, the forms he can take, and what is his real form? Well, he hides himself. Well, he has countless forms. That means a multitude of skins, costumes, disguises he can wear, and then hepa. So, let me see now. Hepa, mara. I'm in the wrong list. hiding himself from in the wedged eye. He hides himself in the eye again. He hides himself in the wedged eye, which is a hypocephalus anyway, from his children. You see, thou art. Then he goes on and says, thou art the naash. Now this word here, thou art the roaring one, naash. The Verita book says, powerful refers especially to strength of the lion in his voice or in his haunches. And thou art in protest, in gentu here, thou art mighty in protest, raising your voice in protest. Gentu, again the Verita book says, klagegeschrei, the roar of a lion or bull. The negative nature of the uproar is clear from our balloon number, 3031, that other one we were showing you, the hieraticon, where the ideogram is the Seth animal. The noise is, well, we can just show that one there, I suppose. Risk it here. Yes, even though we got it backwards. Where he says, oops, but why it always does that. Hiding himself in the, but I see from his enemy here, we're going in this direction now. And there it is, see. Instead of saying, Nejnu, this is the voice of protest, against the voice of, roaring against the voice of, it is the voice of process of test. So this is in the older one, you see. This refers to the controversy between Horus and Seth to fulfill the plan of salvation in the pre-existence as described, say, in the Sabako stone, when they argued as to who should be the son and heir. And Seth was rejected and he became the enemy. But this refers to that argument and debate which was in the council in heaven at the before the creation of the world, when they were planning the creation. So here it goes. The noise is called, in the other one is called, I should have stayed with that one, yes, a lament, an outcry, you two is called here. And yes, this is what it is called here. And we come to here, don't we? You two. Yeah, then, well, that's what it's called anyway. The midst of the great council. The uniting of Ra and Osiris in the eighth hour of the night is the joining of the sun's Ba from above from his body in the tomb. And it's represented by a prone lion called the Bull of Roaring. There you are again. See, we can't drop the lion out, if some people want to. Accompanied by a pair of wedged eyes called the Chi'it Re'u, the image of Ra, while the lion represents the rebirth of the sun god. And we're quoting Bartha there. So this all fits into the picture. And next he's called Great Courser in his rounds. This is right out of Homer, isn't it? The Pesher. See, since it's running backwards, I was used to reading it the other direction. And there it is. Yeah. Oh, that's the crying out Pesher. Go back and then we start at the next line. There it is. The great runner in his rounds. Well, anyway, what it says here is The word it uses here is the running, with reference to the gods, a ceremonial running, back to the Verta book again, a ceremonial running, tesher, the circumambulation, the running of the bounds by the king at the coronation, in imitation of the sun god at the renewing of the earth. So it's all the same pattern, you see, this thing. This vividly recalls the sun god and his rounds in the opening of Homer. Y'all remember that? Hear me, God of the silver bowl, who visits Christ in your rounds, in your course of your rounds, and who visits also, who spends time, who functions as a prince in the other shrines on the way. So the sun god visits his shrines in their rounds, and this comes out very commonly now in the Hypocephalus literature, the sun going around, and he goes as a lion here. The Gardner says, Re Harachdi is the messenger whose regular rounds establish the time units of years, months, days, and hours. So that's Re Harachdi, that's the sun in this capacity doing it. Renewing himself every day, now and then he quotes from the litany, chapter 20 of the Solar Litany, renewing himself every day, watching over all, passing over the earth in an instant, nothing is hidden from him, crossing the sky by ship, through the underworld, he promises to get by. So he's in both, he's equally at home in both. All turn their faces to him. And that is an interesting thing, this turning the faces, bear that in mind, because that's a frequent expression on the hypocephali. In fact, we'll get to them here and see if we get them. Don't want to take up too much time, but so, turning the face, I say, we'll try to bear that in mind. The We missed the place here. Well, yes, here it goes again. Great courser in his run. Now the prayer to him, you see. Thou art strong to come to the aid. Thou art strong, and again he goes through it, and Ash, and again the Verta book says, especially of a lion, thou art strong to come to the aid of one who calls upon him in the manner of one suffering great affliction, or the plague, or on the point of death. Come at my call. This is the prayer that we found, remember, on the hypocephalus. Why the people should say this has nothing at all to do with hypocephalus, I don't know. Come at my call. The prayer for deliverance is in the hypocephalus. I am Ahat the cow. I better take it back here to the other one. I am Ahat the cow. He starts giving his names now. Now he has to exchange secret names, the names at the initiation, because that's how he identifies himself. It shows that he is Mahero, he's justified and has a right to be saved and to be taken away, the God to take it. There's the cow. And then, thy name is in my mouth. We're going to exchange secret names that you learned with the only at the veil. You e erjet, and I will recite it. I'm about to recite it. See, thy name is in my mouth, and I will now recite it to you, so you will hear what it is. I will tell you what the secret name is. Then he goes into a list of strange names. Kahagaga, Sahagaga here. That is thy name, he says. And then Urewi, there's your line again. Urewi, Uyuik, that is thy Ersa Yinik. That is thy name. Oh, that's a long name. Gives these all names, which they say, well, they're just names. We don't know what they mean. They're mystery names. But I say some of them, Alan gives. Now, for example, we come to this very important one. This is the name of the nice list. This is thy name. And then here is a lotus, a lion, and then they wrote out the word ser, a ram here, lotus, lion, and ram here. But this is a very important and significant name. And it's conspicuous on the Joseph Smith, and we see it on here to show how important they think it is. Notice, instead of writing it in hieroglyphic, they write it out and actually draw the picture. The lion, the lotus, or the leaf, the lotus, the lion, and the ram. That has great significance. Later on we'll see what that is. But here you see they don't write it in hieratic, they write it this way. So it's something very special we're talking about here. Go back to the other one now. Backward. Come at my call. My name is in my mouth. And he repeats these. Now, this is broken. This next one, Oh, you're right after that. Right after that is the one. That's Harissa. Harissa. And Alan sees in that the Semitic Harasha, Arabic Harathak, Hebrew Harasha. It means to plow, to cut a groove in, to carve. Therefore, he renders it graven image, something that's graven or carved. But you don't know, see, these things come in. But you see strange Hebrew or Canaanite roots of some sort in them. And then he goes on, the Bull of Roaring is thy name. And rends, the next one, he renders lion, notice, a lion renders the next one, which is on there, he renders it lion, he who rends or embraces of the great goddess is thy name. The tail of the lion, notice he keeps, according to Alan, these are all lion names in here. Tail of the lion is thy name, graven image is thy name, the one I just reported to here. Then he says, I am Achat the cow. Hear my voice, hear my cry on this day. Next comes the combination again of the lotus, lion, and sheep. And it's spelled out. In the Berlin, it's spelled out completely, showing it's very important. Alan interprets the name as me, Circe, or chained lion. He likes to stick with lions here. The significance is clear later on, though. And the next one, Kerosheth, is thy name. And so figures carefully drawn out. Well, I am Achat, hear my voice this day. And so here's the answer. The suppliant now receives the relief he asks for, and that's the instructions that follow in column 6 here, where he's told what to do. Thou shalt shorten me. Besekert. Do what? This one comes here. Yes, going down the long list of names here. There should have been the sixth one that he starts receiving instructions here, and the Kepper F me. Oh, and then he will become as one on earth. Yeah, that's where it begins. This is a very interesting usage. Gardner talks about that. That has it's a future form. It's not usually treated such, but it is. No, you're not interesting. It will cause their. Accordingly, there will come to thee a flame under the head of Ray. Notice he calls him Ray. The married person is Ray. There will be a flame under the head of Ray. And Bexel, behold, he is in. While he is still in the dot, the flame will come. That's where he has to be resurrected anyway. This will cause the flame. It will preserve him, in other words, in the duat. Because behold, he being in the dirt, you see, in Heliopolis, that's where he is. So during the time when the Great Spirit reposes there, it will cause the Ekheper F me. This will cause thee to be like those who are still upon the earth. Ba'ek M. Oh, this is interesting. Ntef Ba'ek. He is thy. See, it's the priest reciting this. And he says, he is thy Ba, he is thy spirit. Remember the Ba coming. Therefore, do not ignore him. This isn't Sechem. Do not forget him. But ignore Chem. Sechem is to remember, forget. Is to forget. But Chem is to ignore. Therefore, do not ignore him. He is yourself. Do not ignore him. Then here comes the prayer. Come to the Osiris, you F. Anak, that he might live. Yeah, well, no, this is actually his name, Uf Anak Mahero. Come to the Osiris, so and so. It's the same thing we've been having all along. He's praying here that he shall come down, the Ba from above shall come down and join him below. And that will cause a flame to be under his head, and he shall be as a Ba. And then it shall be the Ba of, he shall be as. He comes to Theonops to join the corpse. See, there's the picture of the Shet, the corpse, of that great corpse which has been laid to rest, Hepatu, in Heliopolis. There it is again. It shall come down and join in Heliopolis. And Yao Heper, there shall be light. Well, that's your, yes, Yahu, or it's your bird of light, your Ahu. Heper, there shall be, well, this is another name. This, how do you interpret it? Yapu, whatever. The great one shall be, the light shall increase. That is thy name. And then Ati, here's another one. That is thy name too. Yima Yere, come thou then. This is a dative of reference. Come thou, an urgent imperative. Come thou then. Cause there to be, I leaned on that time. No, this one. Yeah, cause him to be, yet cause him to become like one of thy followers. Here it is again. This is the way he's going to get out of the underworld, to get to heaven, nature, to get to heaven, he has to become a follower of the God and join it. So this is putting the supplication to him that he will become as one of thy followers. He is the spirit, well, I mentioned that one here, oh, here it is, as one of thy followers. Yes, ek pa'i, that he might become one of thy followers. He is you and you are he, in tef, you're each other, you join it, well, that's what you're, Jebademji, see, that you're joining to, he is you and you are he, and Jedmeno, and then here, you're supposed to recite this over, this is a female image, a small idol of a female figure, have the figure of a cow here. Pronounce this over the figure of a cow, which is made of pure gold, and place it at the throat of the Ahu, of the glorified one, the person who's going to be glorified and transmitted, so forth, the Ahu, along with that which has been done in writing. You put that, and that you put in writing, and that you put here, which, oh yes, upon a, oh this is a jam. Jam, that's a word for a papyrus, or it's a word for mat. They use the symbol for mat here, and I think they meant cham. The scribe meant cham, which means mat. On a new, fresh mat, fresh ma'ui means fresh or new, on a fresh mat, and place it under his head, and then the flames, and a great flame shall come, a multitude of flames surround him completely, in Kedewef, it shall completely engulf him, as it does for living people. Well, we think something of the Curlian effect here, I suppose. Living people do have some an effect around them, and when you're alive, you have it, and when you're dead, you don't. So, I don't know whether it's Curlian effect or not. And he shall become a god in the where the gods are at rule. And nothing shall hinder him. There shall be no hindrance. Lion hindering again, watching the way. He shall not be hindered at the pass, if you see there. She shall not be hindered before any gate in the underworld. He'll be free to go when he wants to. And then this M Shen Ma. This is a formula that comes hundreds of times. It's in the Joseph Smith Book of Breathings too. It means Altsvar Erprobt. This has been proven and tested many times, and you can rely on this ordinance. It will be effective. And then it takes Jed Ech. And what is it? Oh, Jed Ech. The Ech. Nature Erhehu. Oh, of course. Erhehu Achut. This is. You shall say, I see a way up there, I can't see from this angle. You shall say as you place it at the throat of the glorified one. Yes, the noble shepherds. This is what you'll say. E Yimr. This is found on the rim of a great number of them, all Yemenu, the hidden ones of the hidden one. Yamen is the hidden one, you see. Patenti, thou who art here in heaven. Now we're not in the lower world here, we're in the upper world. And thou who art in heaven. And then here's the prayer again. Yemaher, place thy face, set thy face toward, look toward, set thy face toward the body, toward the corpse of thy son, and cause him to be healed. So wedjau ek, and cause him sell. So wedjau ek sell, and cause him to be healed in the kert netzer, down below, from where you are up in your heaven. Turn your face toward him, and cause that he shall be healed down here below. Then he says, this is a writing he's talking about, this writing is a very great secret thing. Do not thou cause anyone, there's your word for see again, see, there's the stone, to see it, do count the eye of any person, male or female, to see it. That is an abomination. Rekis, if you know it, and you conceal it, hapes, rekis, hapes, you shall seal it, and hide it, this is it here, then kepher, then it shall be so. It's a relative. Whoever hides it, knows it, and conceals it, and does not give it away, it will be to his advantage. Well, however, he will exist, actually, after so. And this is the book. This book is called, its name is, its title is, either Princess of the Temple of the Hidden One, of the Shrine of the Hidden One, or it can mean property of the Temple of Ammon. As far as that goes, that could be enigmatic writing too. And this is the end thereof. So you see, we're right in our hypocephalus area here, and the time is passing, and we're going to get the thing. So, the resurrection must begin where the body is, in the depths of the underworld, where Osiris lies helpless, to which Ra descends to revive him by a fusion process, and thou makest him to become as he was on earth. He is thy Ba, and so forth. The well, we just saw these things, and the instructions, and what comes after that, the secret book. And we have it here. Now, this doctrine is fully developed in the two texts that I was going to treat today, but I won't be able to because the time is up, and I have been in a vile mood. Nobody has the luxury to be in vile moods, you know. There are reasons. Where does this fit in? Well, we'll start out here. This doctrine is most fully developed in two important texts, which, like almost all manuscripts relating to the hypocephali, are quite unique. They're all rather very strange and out of line. And no, I'm not going to get started on this. This is a big one. It's 20 pages long. I can't take you through that. No, not at this particular point. But you begin to see these things hanging together when they say, this has nothing to do with the hypocephalus. I think it has a lot to do with hypocephalus. And it tells us what's been going on all along. And immediately we start thinking of other things. We start thinking of facsimile number one. Who is on the couch now? What is the bird coming to him? What's going to happen to him? And so forth. Is he in the same situation? Well, we'll have to put that off till the next time we come to that. Because I collected over 200 of these men on the lion couch praying businesses. And this, the Joseph Smith, this one is absolutely unique. You see, this is a different thing. We're not discussing that one this time, but we are discussing some more things, and we get to the Abraham part the next time. I'm sure we'll do that, we'll manage that. I thought to get to it this time, and thank you for your long-suffering patience. Boy, we really muffed it this time, didn't we? So we'll... Oh! So see the rest of these? Let me see some of the rest of these, just see what was there. Now, for example, this is too good to miss. This is the first one ever interpreted. But this wasn't until 1850. This is long after the Joseph Smith one came out, you see, 42. This was the first. The thing I want to notice here is, I turned it upside down so I'd bring that part up, where he says, this is the person, the daughter of so-and-so, and so-and-so, and so-and-so. But here it says, turn thy face, notice, D, turn thy face toward the corpse, exactly what we've been reading, you see, on that thing, toward the corpse of thy daughter, and the Osiris, notice, she's the Osiris so-and-so, that's her name. And now the next one is most significant. You don't want to miss this one. This is the Dehorax. Dehorax was the first full commentary. He did the best job on them, except for Layman's himself. But this is a good one. This is a very early, 1887, yes. And notice it says here, here's thy face, turn thy face to the spot. Oh, we get to this one first, though. Here we are. They repeat it twice, you know. This is the interesting thing. He says here, turn thy face to the corpse of the corpse of thy offspring, thy daughter, actually here, that's the term for son, and that's feminine, of thy daughter, Ray, and Netcher S, She is nature es where e ek es m ek before she is, and then she the divine. Well, that's the god sign to go with the name of the ray, kind of. And then sawaj es and heal her. So why just, I'm getting rattled here, we're gonna recognize that. See, they've sort of smeared that out. And heal her. So watch, ek es, thou shalt heal her. And then turn M-S-S-M and then cause her to be in her nature here. But then it goes on, turn thy, give thy face toward the corpse of Osiris. First he says, you heal Ray comes down, you turn your face to Ray, and then you turn your face to Osiris, the same person, you see. It's the meeting of Osiris and Ray. They come together and fuse. That's why I said, remember when we said, turn thy face toward so-and-so, you turn your face toward. So here you turn your face, not toward, here you turn it toward Osiris, that's Osiris, and here you turn it toward, toward Ray, excuse me, boy. Don't ask me for my own name now. And here you turn it toward Osiris, who is in Heret Netzer, and to the daughter of so-and-so, and that's the name of the person here, and cause her to be here, and then you... And here it starts out, you notice, O thou Ammon of the Ammons, or thou hidden one of the hidden ones. He never reveals his name, you see. He hides his form, he takes various forms, but he'll never let you know who he really is, and that's this one here. But that is most interesting, that we have exactly what the brethren have decided the last 5 or 10 years, that what happens really is the big thing, the center of Egyptian religion, is the meeting of Horus and Osiris together, fusion in one and so forth, and that's what you have here. Turn your face toward the Ray, who is the same, the daughter of so-and-so, and then it says, turn your face toward Osiris, who is the daughter of the same person. And they're all changing faces and so forth, and so everybody fuses with everybody else. It's an interesting arrangement. I say it's no more mystifying than the opening chapters of the Gospel of John, isn't it? Well, now we should close. Thank you.